On her subsequent trips to the clinic, she discovered that Tomaszewski was prescribing Versed, one of the drugs that killed Michael Jackson, and that he was making house calls to inject it into rich old ladies in the hills. She found a great many more multi-dose vials of medicine than the doctor claimed to have used. She figured out that when the doctor used one of his multi-dose vials of painkiller on different patients, he changed the needle, but not the syringe. And to prevent the spread of disease, you needed to change both. She found that Dr. Tomaszewski had a second clinic in Oregon in which he performed the same procedures. Behind a door, which she had at first assumed led to a closet, she found a bedroom, which clearly had served as both a recovery room for patients and a crash pad for the doctor. And she learned that the cold young receptionist and beautician was actually the doctor's daughter. It took a few months for the test results to arrive. When they finally did, four more of Tomaszewski's patients were found to have been infected with hepatitis C. All had been treated by the doctor on a single day, September 4th, 2014. None of them knew each other, but their new virus shared the same genome, which proved they'd all been infected by the same source. The culprit turned out to be a single syringe the doctor had used on all the patients. Charity expected the state medical board to dig deeper. They never did. I called them and said, "We thought you were launching an investigation." They said, "We are, but it consists of you telling us what you've found." The subsequent report by the Medical Board of California explained that Dr. Tomaszewski had violated a great many standard operating procedures. The state of California stripped him of his license to practice medicine, and he eventually was asked to close his practice in Oregon. With that, his career in medicine ended. By then, Charity Dean knew that in her request to stop the spread of disease, she was more or less on her own. She had her friends and allies, the public health nurses, for example, who were among the more impressive human beings she had ever known. She was also growing to adore Santa Barbara's chief counsel, who kept handing her enough rope to hang herself by confirming that, yes, the law allowed her to do whatever the hell she thought needed doing to protect the public. She felt a deep connection to the 57 other California County health officers, though they were, she had to admit, a mixed bag. Some were ancient doctors who viewed the job as a sinecure. Some were part-timers who didn't even seem all that interested in the job. There's no defined career path to becoming a public health officer, and that's a problem, she said. You get the retired anesthesiologist who is spending most of his time as a professional dog breeder. But some of her fellow local health officers, like Charity herself, were so deeply committed to the job that they experienced it more as a mission. These people she loved best, but their needs and issues were too diverse for them to function as a single, powerful unit. And they weren't in a position to have her back in a crisis. The larger apparatus of American public health was very different on the inside from how Charity had imagined it from the outside. The Centers for Disease Control, the Apex Authority, wasn't of much practical use to her. The distance they had put between themselves and her when she closed Tomaszewski's clinic was of a piece with their general behavior. She'd repeatedly seen the tendency to flee when conflict arose. At the end of 2013, for instance, as she was promoted to chief health officer, she had a call from a local hospital saying that a 19-year-old student athlete at the University of California, Santa Barbara, had just been brought in by friends with symptoms of meningitis B. He was now in the intensive care unit in a state of shock. The disease was rare, but still terrified student health doctors, as it attacked healthy young people and could kill them in hours. It's one of the most feared diseases for student health doctors, said Mary Ferris, UCSB's medical director. We knew right then people's lives were at risk. No one knew exactly all the ways the disease might spread. The one known path was through saliva. There was no agreement on what actions to take on a college campus in the event of an outbreak. We spoke with the CDC and asked them what to do, said Dr. Ferris, but the CDC initially wasn't too impressed. We rely on them for advice on what to do, and their advice was to do nothing. The initial problem was that there was no clear diagnosis. The attending physician in that first possible case was none other than Dr. Stephen Hosey, who had taught Charity Dean much of what she knew about diagnosing disease. The young man's legs, Dr. Hosey told her, were purple, but the lab test of the young man's blood and spinal fluid had come back negative for meningitis B and essentially eliminated the possibility that he was carrying a dangerous communicable disease. Diagnosing an infectious disease is like following a path with clues along the way. The Gram stain, the test that came back negative for meningitis, was the first clue. It told you in which of two big buckets the bacteria you were dealing with belonged. It's very reliable, said Charity, and it's hard to fuck it up. But at the same time, Dr. Hosey said he was standing there looking at the mottled purple legs of the young man. To stop the infection from moving farther up his body, he could already see they'd need to amputate both legs. What do you think? She asked him. What do you think? He asked back, which threw her. She couldn't figure out if he was testing her, the way he'd done when she was his student, or treating her as a colleague. I think the Gram stain is wrong, she said. As it happened, he'd already asked the lab how often the Gram stain had been wrong, and they had said never. But the Gram stain was to him mainly of academic interest. He was already treating the young man for meningitis B just in case. I know what it means for me to ignore the lab report and assume it is meningitis B, he said, and it's very different from what it means for you. In other words, a misdiagnosis carried no professional risk for him. For her, the risk was massive. What do you think? She asked again. I think the Gram stain is wrong too, he said. The Gram stain was indeed wrong. But that would take a day and a half to figure out. They didn't have time to wait for another test. If one kid had the disease, others surely did too. If 6 kids had it today, 12 kids might be infected the following week, and if 12 had it next week, 24 might have it the week after. And if, well, it wasn't long before she'd have an epidemic on her hands. I knew I had to stay ahead of it, said Charity. Because 90% of the battle is in the first few days. But in the beginning, it's always quiet, and you are quietly making decisions, and you're a nut job. And so the intervening calls with the CDC were maddening, but she soon learned, always the same. An email would go out to set up the call, and there would be 20 people inside the CDC copied on it. The email addresses were people's initials, so she never knew most of their names. On the call itself, she'd find herself talking to the CDC's resident expert on meningitis outbreaks, with a dozen or more others on the line. It's very eerie, she said. It feels like it's a movie, and you think you're in a one-on-one conversation, but there's a wall that's two-way glass with 20 other people lurking behind it. It was almost like he was playing a role for the 20 people behind the glass. After each call, she'd go online and look up the CDC org chart to try to figure out who these people were and which division they were in, but she couldn't find them anywhere. They were an invisible mob inside an ivory tower. The calls themselves irritated rather than informed her. They'd do mental masturbation, said Charity. Mental masturbation is actually an important concept. It's when you talk in circles for an hour and reach no decision. But at the end of these sessions, I had to make a decision. The first decision was to scour the student population for cases that had gone undetected. Charity instructed the Santa Barbara medical community to test any young person who turned up with a low-grade fever. It's not those people with mild symptoms you worry about, she said. It's the people they infect and the exponential growth. As the CDC dithered, three more UCSB students tested positive for meningococcal disease. Each case presented differently. One student, with only a rash, had been diagnosed initially with chickenpox. The other two had slight fevers and had been initially misdiagnosed as having nothing special. None of them lived together, recalled Dr. Ferris, UCSB's medical director. It was really sort of hard to understand why we had these random cases. Within days, the school had set up hotlines to field calls from panicked parents, along with complaints from citizens of Santa Barbara who thought that the school's 20,000 students should be confined to their rooms. Charity stayed up nights staring at the whiteboards in her office, on which she had charted the social relationships of the infected UCSB students. At the top of the board, she had written, cross-pollination, a term of art she'd picked up from Dr. Hosey. It's when you don't want to say he had sex with her and what kind of sex they had, she said. But I was basically trying to figure out who had shared saliva with whom and where they'd shared it. All signs pointed to the Greek system. She decided to shut down the college sororities and fraternities and give the 1,200 students in them a prophylactic drug. With meningitis B, you have a very narrow window to give the prophylaxis, she explained. And it was a weekend. You had to do it fast and all at once, or else the pathogen just keeps circulating. She got on the phone with the main guy at the CDC and his silent crowd. The guy strongly disagreed with her doing anything. What he actually said, recalled Charity, was, that decision is not supported by the data. I said, oh, really? There is no data. She outlined a plan she'd created. Thin out the dorms by moving some of the students into hotel rooms. Shut down the intramural sports teams and administer a vaccine that had been approved in Europe, but that the FDA had not yet signed off on. The CDC guy said, we're not going to do any of that, and if you do that, we're going to put it in writing that it was your decision and we disagreed with it, Charity recalled. There followed other calls with the CDC, each more dismissive of her than the last. After one of them, Paige Batson turned to her boss and said, Dr. Dean, I've never heard anyone at the CDC speak to someone like that. But in the end, the campus ignored the CDC and did everything Dr. Dean recommended. It was kind of a stern order, said Dr. Ferris, and it had never been done before. But after she stopped all the parties and administered the prophylaxis, we had no more cases. From start to finish, what Dr. Ferris and everyone noticed was that, as Dr. Ferris put it, the CDC wasn't pleased with her. The CDC kept saying, there is no evidence to back it up. They didn't have any evidence because there is only one case every 4 years. The root of the CDC's behavior was simple. Fear. They didn't want to take any action for which they might later be blamed. The message they send is, we're better than you and smarter than you, but we're letting you stick your neck out to take the risk, said Charity. They would argue with me about how kids behave in fraternities and sororities, and I had been president of Kappa Delta. In the middle of the crisis, Charity figured out what it would take to appease the nation's highest authority on infectious disease. It was when they said, if any of this works, you won't know which one worked, she recalled. They said, "You need to do these things one at a time and gather evidence." They wanted to learn from this meningitis outbreak, and I wanted to stop it. My goal was to stop it, and that was not their goal. They wanted to observe it, as if it were a science experiment on how meningitis moves through a college campus. And I was like, "Are you kidding me? A kid just lost his feet." Charity never would know which of the measures she took had controlled the disease. She knew only that all of them together had. To her, all that really mattered was that the disease had been contained. The job of the public health officer, or at least her job as the public health officer, was a series of intense firefights. There was no standard operating procedure for many of the situations in which she found herself. Usually, they were sufficiently different from anything that had ever before happened. If she waited until she had enough evidence to publish in a scientific journal, the battle would be over, and she'd have lost. Kids would lose limbs or die. The decisions she was forced to make were less like, say, those made by a card counter at a blackjack table, and more like the ones made by a platoon leader in combat. She never had all the data she wanted or needed when making her decisions. Enough so that afterwards she could defend them by saying, "I just did what the numbers told me to do." The hard truth was that there was never time to wait for more data. The moment an infectious disease appeared, decisions cried out to be made. The longer you waited, the more likely it was that people would die waiting for you to decide, or waiting for you to gather the data you needed to cover your ass if your decisions proved wrong. 2 years after the UCSB meningitis outbreak, the CDC finally published a report on how to deal with a meningitis outbreak on a college campus. On its list of best practices were most of the things Charity had done at UCSB. After that, from time to time, someone would call her from the CDC and ask her if she'd please get on the phone with some college health officer somewhere in the United States and describe how she handled the UCSB outbreak. But by then, Charity had washed her hands of the CDC. "I banned their officers from my investigations," she said. The CDC did many things. It published learned papers on health crises after the fact. It managed very carefully public perception of itself. But when the shooting started, it leapt into the nearest hole while others took fire. "In the end, I was like, 'Fuck you,'" said Charity. "I was mad they were such pansies. I was mad that the man behind the curtain ended up being so disappointing." In theory, the CDC sat atop the system of infectious disease management in the United States. In practice, the system had configured itself to foist the political risk onto a character who had no social power. It required a local health officer to take the risk and responsibility, as no one else wanted to. Charity could see that the CDC's strategy was politically shrewd. People were far less likely to blame a health officer for what she didn't do than what she did. Sins of commission got you fired. Sins of omission you could get away with. But they left people dead. The health officer's job was to choose, all by herself, the direction in which to err, do too much or too little. "I did not sign up to be that kind of brave," said Charity. "That wasn't my plan. I was always saying to the CDC, 'This is your job. Do your job.' But after the UCSB outbreak, my motto was, 'Stop waiting for someone to come and save you, because no one is coming to save you.'" Paige Batson could not spend 7 years playing Watson to her boss's Holmes without being at least dimly aware of how much her boss remained an unsolved mystery. The year after she'd arrived in the public health office, back in 2012, Dr. Dean had left her husband, a Santa Barbara surgeon who had wanted her to quit to be a stay-at-home mom. Dr. Dean would refer to her private life as a dumpster fire, and Paige sensed that was just a way for her to put it all in a box to be stored. There was a void inside her boss, she thought. Yet somehow, in the midst of everything, she was raising three boys while working 80-hour weeks. She was on call 24/7, said Paige. She'd take calls at 2 a.m, telling her that a man with 4+ tuberculosis had just been released from county jail. The number was a measure of infectiousness. In the end, Paige decided that it wasn't really her place to intrude upon Dr. Dean's private life, as she herself never allowed that life to intrude upon their work. There was never a blip, she said. Wherever she parked it all, she parked it all. The big thing about her boss, Paige thought, was that an American public health officer, at some risk to herself, had taken the job of protecting the public's health as seriously as it had ever been taken. The Montecito mudslide was the final case in point. It was one of those Book of Job-like events in which Santa Barbara County specialized. On December 7, 2017, a fire swept down from Ventura County. It grew big enough to earn its own name, the Thomas Fire. Then it grew even bigger, into the largest wildfire in the recorded history of California. In the dead of winter, in a county of less than 500,000 people, more than 100,000 people had to be evacuated. The ash that fell in downtown Santa Barbara was not the light dusting they usually got. It rose above the street curbs. It became dangerous to breathe and impossible to tell what colors the cars had been. When the county's emergency response team went looking for a precedent for how to deal with the volume of ash, the only one they could find was the eruption of the Mount St. Helens volcano back in 1980. But the Thomas Fire was just the opening act. It burned the vegetation in the Santa Ynez Mountains, above the town of Montecito, so there was nothing to grip the soil and rock. The National Weather Service forecast for January 8, 2018, was for a heavy rain. A team from the federal government created a forecast for a possible landslide. The county issued a mandatory evacuation of the hills around Highway 192, the road on which Oprah lived and where Ellen was buying. The houses were huge, many of them second homes of the distant rich. Matt Pontes saw right away how hard it was to persuade people that the mountain in the distance might more or less collapse on them. Pontes had been a firefighter in the U.S. Forest Service until he blew out his knees one too many times, after which he'd gone into emergency response. When 2018 came around, he was assistant CEO of Santa Barbara County and dealing with a problem that didn't arise from wildfire. Californians had experienced wildfire. Often they could actually see it coming. When a fire was bearing down on them, you didn't need to holler at people to get them to evacuate. This was a different beast. People had never seen a mudslide, and in truth, the event was hard to imagine. It's blue skies, said Pontes. It's something that's never happened before, at least not in memory. It was, hey, something's coming. It's not a fire. We gotta get you out of here. And they said no. The storm on January 8th was even worse than the forecast had led residents to believe it might be. It rained more than 0.5 inch inside of 5 minutes and 1.5 inches in a single hour. Around 3 a.m. of January 9th, the mountain that looms over Montecito, in effect, melted and rushed down upon the town. The water and mud moved at such speed that boulders the size of automobiles skipped along their surface. Cars parked up in the hills were caught and dragged down for miles until finally deposited on the ocean. Over the next week or so, first responders dug out 23 bodies from the mud. 2 were never found. Some of the dead were never honestly counted. including the bodies of old people found weeks later, still in their armchairs, depleted oxygen tanks beside them. The mudslide forecast proved incredibly prescient. The mountain moved exactly as the experts had predicted. "It could not have been more accurate if they had cheated," said Charity. Her first job, she realized, was to figure out what was in the mud. Over Christmas break, before the big rains came, she'd declared a public health emergency to enable crews to go onto the private property of the absent rich and clear the debris from the fire. "There is this hazardous pile of toxic goop. You have just set all the chemicals in your garage on fire. Now you are about to put a hose on it and spread it into the waterways." The cleanup crews made only a dent in the mess before the rains, and now the mess was everywhere. "I needed to know what microbial pathogens are there, to know which vaccines do you give the first responders and utility workers." No one seemed to have any idea. She tried to educate herself. No one had ever published anything on wading through mud in an urban setting, she said. "It's so rare." The federal and state governments were now helping with the response, and the director of the California Department of Public Health, Dr. Karen Smith, suggested that Charity try to figure out what was in the mud on her own. So I said, "Okay, I'm going to make a list. I'm going to guess what's out there." She started with the likely bacteria, E. coli, Clostridium tetani, the cause of tetanus, before moving on to viruses like hepatitis B, and finally other single-cell organisms. "The one that really scared me was Vibrio cholera," she said. "This was a ripe setting for cholera." She tracked rashes. When first responders came off their shifts, she'd pull up the legs of their pants and inspect their skin. "That's the only way to know what diseases they might be coming back with," she said. "We had no surveillance system. I was the surveillance system, seeing what disease emerged from the muck." She went on local television to tell anyone with a rash to call her. What turned up, she first mistook for chemical burns. Then she figured it out. The oil from poison oak had mixed with liquid and blended into the mud. They ended up giving it its own name, the Montecito rash. But then almost everyone in Montecito had cleared out. However, for some reason, Charity could not fathom people were still wandering around Casa Dorinda. Casa Dorinda was a rich person's old age home. Julia Child famously had ended her days there. Now it was the sort of place to which billionaires sent their mothers. A second big storm was about to hit. The same forecasters who had predicted with such fantastic accuracy where mud would flow the first time around thought the most likely path of the next mudslide was right through Casa Dorinda, and no one was doing anything about it. Late one afternoon, a week after the mudslide, Charity drove up as close to Casa Dorinda as she could. She had brought with her another doctor to check my judgment and the county council, because I didn't want there to be two versions of the conversation. What she really needed was a map and a compass. She had a terrible sense of direction and was forced to guess where she was going. Street signs had vanished along with the streets. She drove as far as she could and then parked and walked through the mud. The sights were shocking. The video she and everyone else had seen, taken from helicopters, didn't do justice to the destruction. It looked like a war zone. A tsunami of rushing mud in places 15 feet high had taken out massive homes. A few of them hung from trees. Giant septic tanks littered the ground like fallen fruit. The doors of the houses in which bodies had been found were marked with a red X. The mud was the most incredible thing. What would turn out to be 4.5 million wheelbarrows of toxic debris wasn't simply going to be returned to the mountain. She realized that she'd need to help them figure out the safest place to put it, and that people wouldn't like the answer. The public health officer is like the garbage disposal, she said. Whatever issue can't be filed into someone else's box or slot winds up in the health officer's. Casa Dorinda itself sat in the middle of the devastation. At the gates outside, the first responders were extracting a body from the mud. But on the other side of those gates was a sight charity couldn't believe. Hundreds of people, many of them ancient, carried on as if nothing had happened. Their garden was pristine. The mud from the first slide had missed the fancy old age home. It was as if their money acted as a magic bubble. I'm thinking, shoot, I'm wrong, said Charity. This place looks perfectly preserved. I've overreacted. Then the sun went down. She watched as Casa Dorinda went dark. It had no power. I get up to the door, and they have camp light, Charity recalled. They had one backup generator and were using the swimming pool for drinking water. When she found the medical director and asked what he thought he was doing, he said that some of the residents were too frail to be moved. The math, to Charity, wasn't complicated. The forecasters put the chance of another mudslide wiping out the place and the 100 or so people inside at 20%. The medical director estimated that there was a 100% chance that 5 of the residents would die if forced to evacuate. It was like that famous problem taught to college freshmen in ethics classes across the country. You, college freshmen, are driving a train. Ahead on the tracks, you spot 5 people. Do nothing, and the train will run them over and kill them. But you have an option. You can flip a switch and send the train onto a siding on which, unfortunately, there stands a man named Carl. Do nothing, and you kill 5 people. Flip the switch, and you kill Carl. Most college freshmen elect to kill Carl, and then, wham, the professor hits them with the follow-up. Carl has 5 healthy organs that can be harvested and used to save the lives of 5 people in need of them. All you need to do is shoot Carl in the back of the head. Would you do that too? If not, explain the contradiction. It can take a week for a college ethics class to sort through that one. Inside Casa Dorinda, Charity had 30 minutes. I knew what I had to do, she said. I didn't want to do it. I was asking myself, is there any way out of this? The answer came back, no. She looked around and found that the fire sprinklers didn't work, and that alone, she told the medical director, was grounds for shutting the place down. I told them, we can do this the easy way or the hard way, said Charity. They were very upset, but they decided to do it voluntarily. Sure enough, there were 7 deaths. Their medical director sent me a scathing email saying, their deaths are on you. He was right. The second mudslide never came. A lot of people were now watching her. One of them was the guy running the disaster response. I thought, where in the world did she come from? Said Matt Pontus. She was just different. She was especially different from anyone he'd known in government. Her receptors were just very keen, said Pontes. And she processes information fast, and it spits out decisions, and it makes people get nervous. And it makes government people really nervous. You don't find people like her in government. It felt almost like an accident that she was there. She'd made the right decision to evacuate Casa Dorinda, he thought. But it was a decision that she could have avoided if she had wanted to. There are 2 ways to be a health officer, he said. One is to pretend it's not happening. She didn't do that. Someone else who'd become a Charity Dean watcher was Dr. Karen Smith. After the mudslide, she called Charity to ask if she'd move to Sacramento to serve as her deputy at the State Department of Public Health. There needed to be another person who can step in as the state's health officer if I get hit by a bus, Dr. Smith said later, and it was clearly her. Charity, at 40, was a generation younger than Smith and young for the job. It paid $50,000 less than she was now making, and never mind the $72,000 in student loan forgiveness she'd been putting at risk. And the offer took her by surprise. Why me? She asked Dr. Smith. Because you make decisions, said the doctor. The deeper why of it all went unexplored. Why did she make decisions? Why had she self-consciously cultivated the ability to do it? She'd long ago stopped telling people why she did what she did for a living. Or at any rate, she didn't tell them the whole story. Something was coming. She felt it. She'd obsessed about it since childhood and had learned not to talk about it because other people thought she was kooky when she did. But as she drove into Sacramento, one subject was at the front of her mind. And not long after she arrived, toward the end of 2018, a journalist asked her about it. What scares me most and what I think about most, said Charity, is our ability to respond to a new pathogen, maybe one we've never seen before, or an old pathogen, like influenza that's just mutated. The H1N1 pandemic of 1918 was over 100 years ago now. The world is overdue for a pandemic like that, whether it's influenza or something else. And in public health, we know that we have to be prepared for that. 3. The Pandemic Thinker. As it happened, the United States of America had a plan to fight a pandemic. The first draft had been written back in October 2005 by a man named Rajiv Venkaya. In the basement of his parents' house in Xenia, Ohio. He'd given himself just a weekend to write it, but even that felt to him like too much. The president was waiting, and not patiently. The story of how the United States more or less invented pandemic planning began when George W. Bush, in the summer of 2005, read a book. Written the year before, it was the same volume that had dropped Bob Glass's jaw. John Barry's The Greatest Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. Bush was the modern president perhaps most frequently reminded that freakishly terrible events can and do happen. He presided over the deadliest ever attack on American soil and the deadliest American natural disaster in a century. Hurricane Katrina was still in his thoughts and on his daily schedule, when he picked up Barry's account of the 1918 Spanish flu. Inside of 18 months, a virus had killed somewhere between 40 and 60 million people around the world, but Barry focused on the American carnage. At least 500,000 Americans, most of them young, had died. A similar culling of the far larger population in 2005 would kill 1.5 million Americans. If anything like Barry described were to occur again, it would distort American life in the most fantastic ways and leave it forever changed. Bush returned to the White House from his summer vacation with a new interest in pandemics. His concern led to a meeting in the Oval Office on October 14, 2005, to which Rajiv Venkaya was invited. Though he was the junior person in the room, Rajiv's medical training had invested him with a nebulous authority. Which was funny, as he'd never really wanted to be a doctor, but had let his father talk him into going to med school. Even during school, I know I'm not going to sit in an office seeing patients, said Rajiv. I'm not going to be in a lab. I knew I wanted to do something bigger. I just didn't know what that was. In the end, he'd used his medical degree as a ticket to the border of medicine and government. He'd landed a White House fellowship back in 2002 at the age of 35, and then worked his way into an obscure unit of the Homeland Security Council that dealt with biological threats to the American people. The Biodefense Directorate, it was weirdly called. In the summer of 2005, he'd been named the unit's head. The Homeland Security Council was staffed mainly by military types who spent their days imagining and preparing for attacks by hostile foreigners. Even the Biodefense Directorate was mainly consumed by anthrax and ricin, and fantasies of terrorists injecting themselves with smallpox and then wandering around the United States infecting people. There was neither status in nor congressional funding for worrying about the flu. The hardcore biodefense types didn't like to talk about it because it isn't interesting to them, said Rajiv. H5N1, a flu strain, appears in poultry in Hong Kong. Who the fuck wants to talk about chickens? Even at the time, the distribution of worry struck Rajiv as a bit odd. In 2003, a new strain of flu found in geese and other migratory birds had jumped into 120 humans and killed half of them. Migratory birds migrated. That same year, a new coronavirus had moved, probably from an animal called a masked palm civet, into humans, infecting 8,000 people and killing 800. A mutation here or a mutation there, and either one of these viruses could have wreaked havoc on American life. Yet in national security policy circles, the threats posed by nature remained someone else's problem. Then Bush read John Barry's book and asked, "What's our strategy?" "We didn't have a strategy," said Rajiv. Instead, they had an unsatisfying document. Recently generated by the Department of Health and Human Services, it laid out plans, in the event of a pandemic, to speed up the production of vaccines and stockpile antiviral drugs. That was the reason for the Oval Office meeting. Bush had read it and hated it. The president said, "This is bullshit," Rajiv recalled. "It's just health. We need a whole-of-society plan. What are you going to do about foreign borders and travel and commerce? And how are you going to stop hundreds of thousands of Americans from dying while they waited for even a speeded-up vaccine?" If anything like the 1918 flu occurred, the basic functions of the society would come to a halt, and no one in the federal government seemed to have worried about it. The point, said Rajiv, was that the president was pissed. At the end of the meeting, Fran Townsend, the Homeland Security Advisor, told President Bush that they'd have a plan for him in 2 weeks. It was new and a bit odd for the White House to put itself in charge of creating a new strategy for disease control, especially as there was an entire federal agency down in Atlanta called the Centers for Disease Control. "The CDC was frustrated," said Rajiv. "Plus, it was not at all clear what the new plan might be." Various White House staffers with various ideas sat down and tossed them around. "We wasted the first week," said Rajiv. "It was smart people trying to create the thing by consensus. You can't write a strategy by committee." He decided he'd just take the notes he'd made in the White House meetings with him back to his parents' house in Ohio and write it himself. The house was on the 7th fairway of the Country Club of the North. But for the occasional golf ball crashing through his parents' living room window, he'd have peace and quiet. "I wrote the whole thing in 6 hours on Friday night," he said. The federal government had a well-earned reputation for moving slowly. Rajiv marveled at just how fast it could move when the president was pissed. He returned from his parents' house on October 23, 2005. 5 days later, all of the cabinet secretaries had signed off on his 12-page document. 4 days after that, on November 1st, Bush gave a speech at the National Institutes of Health, announcing the new strategy. It had three parts to it. to detect outbreaks overseas so they might remain there, to stockpile vaccines and antiviral drugs, and finally, to be ready to respond at the federal, state, and local levels in the event that a pandemic reaches our shores. Whatever that meant. Bush did not elaborate much because Rajiv hadn't either. The 12 pages he'd written on his own amounted less to a plan than a plan to have a plan. It was written for an audience of one, the president, said Rajiv, to get the president off the ledge. 11 days after Rajiv sat down in his parents' basement, Bush asked the U.S. Congress for $7.1 billion to spend on his three-part pandemic strategy, and Congress gave it to him. To staffers on the U.S. House Appropriations Committee, John Barry's The Great Influenza became known as the $7 billion book. The first John Barry heard of any of this was when Bush was asked at a press conference in September 2005 what he'd done with his summer vacation, and he mentioned reading Barry's book. Barry later learned that Stuart Simonson, a senior aide to Mike Leavitt, the newly appointed secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, had handed his boss the book and said, "When we have a pandemic, there's going to be a 9/11 report, and you're going to be the bad guy in it. So you'd better read this." Leavitt had read it and asked Simonson for 50 copies, marked up to highlight the important bits, one of which he gave to Bush. "It was an inflection point," said Simonson. "Up till then, there was no money for this. People would say, 'Oh, it's just the flu.' To this day, Barry has never heard from Bush. But the book offered no advice about what to do with the $7 billion. The book, truth be told, left the reader feeling that there was little that might have been done to prevent all those people from dying. But the memo that Rajiv had bashed out in his parents' basement was vague enough to allow the White House to do whatever it wanted, and now he had $7 billion with which to do it. The plan gives you cover to do all sorts of things," said Rajiv. "It gave us license to go and figure things out." The whole enterprise felt not just new, but audacious. The United States took this on as a national priority before anyone in the world, said Rajiv. "We want to use all instruments of national power to confront this threat. We were going to invent pandemic planning." Yet he was still more or less on his own, and he needed to produce an actual plan, one that explained what exactly needed to be done and who was going to do it. He asked for and was given permission to hire 7 people from relevant federal agencies to help. His first pick was Richard Hatchett, another doctor who had stopped treating patients and moved into government service. Richard belonged to a dying species, the romantic southern man of letters who travels north and there makes an uneasy home for himself. He'd grown up in Daphne, Alabama, and in 1985 had gone off to Vanderbilt University, where his poetry caught the eye of the eminent poets in residence, Donald Davey and Mark Jarman. They'd picked him to represent Vanderbilt at a national collegiate poetry competition, in which he finished 2nd. A judge, the future Pulitzer Prize-winning Irish poet, Paul Muldoon, singled out one of his poems as the work of a young poet of promise. When asked why, instead of pursuing a career as a poet, he had gone to medical school, Richard would say simply, "Writing is too hard." In September 2001, he was working in the emergency room at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City and preparing to start a fellowship in oncology. On September 11th, he moved to a field hospital that arose spontaneously in Stuyvesant High School, where he ran triage for the rescue workers at Ground Zero. Years later, he wrote a letter to his newborn son describing the feelings of that moment. "What positive I remember about that day and the weeks that followed was the profound social cohesion and solidarity of communities and the desire of individuals to serve and contribute. That sounds superficially like patriotism, and in a sense it is patriotism of the best sort, but in fact, at least for me, it was more complex than that. What we experienced had more to do with communities coming together than it did with a sense of national identity. It had more in common with the social cohesion that occurs after a tornado or hurricane, at least for the first few days, than it did with the nationalism of people at war. The call for doctors and nurses after the 9/11 attacks struck Richard as so haphazard that afterward, he wrote a crisp memo to the people who ran the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, arguing that they should use whatever political clout they had to push for a national medical reserve corps. A week or so later, a nurse interrupted him while he was dealing with a fever in a patient on chemotherapy. Someone was on the phone and insisting on speaking with him personally. Richard was irritated, as fever could kill you when your blood count was low. "This is Noreen Hines from the Vice President's office," said the voice on the other end of the line. "How can I help you?" bristled Richard, while thinking, "Vice President? Vice President of what?" "General Lawler has read your medical proposal," she said. General Bruce Lawler, a member of the Bush White House team that wrote the plan to create the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Noreen Hines is an infectious disease specialist, then posted to the White House. It took Richard a moment to realize, "Oh, Vice President Cheney," he said. "There's another vice president?" she asked. The people at the foundation, without telling him, had sent his memo to someone in Washington, who had sent it to someone else, and so on, until it reached the White House. In his 2002 State of the Union address, President Bush would call for the creation of a reserve medical corps. Richard would move to Washington to help set it up inside the Department of Health and Human Services. By the time they'd finished, the Medical Reserve Corps had 100 offices and 200,000 medical volunteers. In the bargain, Richard entered the subculture of federal emergency response. A pair of recent events had pushed the threat of bioterrorism to the front of the minds of the people who worked in and around national security. One was the series of anthrax attacks on Capitol Hill in October 2001. The other was an exercise conducted a few months before those attacks, called Dark Winter. In the summer of 2001, a bunch of smart people in and around the U.S. government gathered at Andrews Air Force Base and thought through a bioterrorist attack on the U.S. population. In the imaginary attack on shopping malls in Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Oklahoma City, 3,000 Americans are infected with smallpox. The disease had been eradicated in the 1970s, vaccine was scarce, and so the U.S. population was vulnerable to any new introduction of the virus. The imaginary exercise did not end well. Just a few months after the hypothetical attack, 3 million Americans were infected. 1 million were dead. Then came the real attack of September 11th, 2001. And following it, the Bush administration's weird shifting of public attention and fear from the Saudis, who had actually led the attacks onto Iraq and Saddam Hussein. The last big smallpox outbreak had occurred in Iraq in 1972, when Saddam was in power. Saddam took an obvious delight in biological weapons. The possibility that Saddam Hussein had preserved the smallpox virus preoccupied the Bush administration. Richard had no obvious place in the national security conversation and was surprised that when the conversation turned to bioterrorism, his new colleagues assumed, because he was a doctor, he might have something to offer. I was going to stuff I didn't really belong at, he said. I would be going to these meetings at the White House or the Homeland Security Council. There'd be a bunch of generals and some question comes up, and they're all looking down the table at me. I'm like the doctor at the table. By January 2003, Richard found himself giving a talk at the Pentagon on how the country might minimize illness and death if terrorists seeded it with smallpox. He didn't really think that terrorists would attack the United States with smallpox. I was never really able to suspend my disbelief. If you are a terrorist, there are better ways to achieve what you want to achieve. But at the request of the Defense Department, he thought through a smallpox attack all by himself, from the ground up. The way I solve a hard problem is not to start with the conventional wisdom, but to start over. He began to make drawings on napkins, using little dots to represent people, and circles to represent networks of people. And before long, he was off and running. The problem, as he framed it for the Pentagon, was how to slow the spread of a communicable disease until you can produce a vaccine. As communicable disease spreads through social networks, Richard reasoned, you had to find ways to disrupt those networks. And the easiest way to do that was to move people physically farther apart from each other, increasing effective social distance as a strategy, he called it. Social distance had been used by anthropologists to describe kinship, but he didn't know that at the time, and so he thought he was giving birth to a phrase. But I don't think I turned it into a gerund, he'd later say. What he also didn't realize was that he was giving new life to a dead idea, that apart from isolating people who were ill, you needed to do anything you could to slow the spread of a disease before you had drugs to help. I was this emergency room doctor, he said. I didn't know that people said all this stuff had been tried in 1918 and it hadn't worked. I wasn't rejecting anything. I just didn't know any better. When Rajiv Venkaya called him in late 2005, Richard was running a program at the National Institutes of Health to study and treat radiation exposure. He'd been asked by a person in the White House working on medical countermeasures in the event of a nuclear attack to help prepare for one, but he sensed that the real value in his work might wind up being in the treatment of cancer. If you could figure out ways to prevent tissue damage during radiation therapy, you could use it more safely, and so maybe use a lot more of it on the cancer cells. I viewed the likelihood of an atomic bomb going off in an American city as essentially zero, said Richard. I was taking this job to work on another threat I didn't believe in, but at least I could develop products that could have a broader value. Like Rajiv, Richard thought that the United States government was paying too much attention to the threats posed by people and too little to those posed by nature. Like Rajiv, he believed that some new strain of flu or some similar respiratory virus was an accident waiting to happen. And so when he heard Rajiv's offer to create a pandemic plan for the country, he was all in. His employer, on the other hand, was not. The National Institutes of Health didn't want to let him go. It caused some bitterness when I asked for him, recalls Rajiv. We had to ask Tony Fauci for permission. Rajiv didn't know the other six people he was about to bring into the White House. He'd sent out requests to the relevant agencies for a certain kind of person. Quick learner. Good teammate. Trusted by the top brass inside their agencies. The task at hand was so unusual that he also asked for people who could think outside the box. Soon, he had a team. The State Department sent him someone to think through how to coordinate with foreign governments, to find and contain new viruses before they even got to the United States, The Justice Department sent him someone to create a strategy for safeguarding law enforcement in the courts. And so on. All these people were of a certain Washington type. Smart. Schooled in the inner workings of the federal government. Experienced in the crafting of national policy. They were all insiders. Even by then, Richard Hatchett. The guy sent by the Department of Veteran Affairs was the glaring exception. Rajiv had figured that he needed someone from the VA as it ran the nation's largest hospital system and, during a pandemic, might be tapped both for hospital beds and for data about what was going on around the country. The VA sent not a policy person, not a Washington person, not a person who knew anything about pandemics, not a person who looked at all that happy wearing a suit and tie, but a doctor from Atlanta named Carter Mesher. As it turned out, he would make all the difference. Carter Mesher had only ever wanted to be a doctor, but the world kept finding other uses for him. He'd grown up in a big working-class family in Chicago. Though his father hadn't finished the 9th grade, he had a highly successful career as a tool and die maker, and as a parent. He encouraged his children to tackle problems with the same competence that he shaped steel. "If some other dumb fuck can do it, so can you," he liked to say. He'd said exactly that when Carter asked him if he thought he could become a doctor. Carter loved his father's ability to make anything out of steel and inherited his father's gift. Working with his hands, Carter became perfectly focused. Otherwise, his mind refused to sit still. "I think I have ADD, he'd say. "I have something like that. I wander all over the fucking place." By the time he reached college, he'd grown so used to not paying attention in class, and instead thinking about whatever he wanted to think about, that he would just make note of whatever book the professor was talking about so that he could go read it on his own later. There were exceptions, though. Times when Carter's mind would lock into a problem in the same way it did when he was fixing a car engine. That was when he was at his best and most himself. An inability to pay attention to anything except that which you find totally riveting might not sound like the most promising trait in a medical student. But almost by process of elimination, it led Carter to his calling, critical care. Just about everyone found their first hours inside the intensive care of the hospital jarring and upsetting. Patients who survived often suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. In the ICU, medical students were most likely to discover their fears. Long stretches with nothing but the faint beeping of machines against a quiet background hum. Then, bam! Lights flashed and alarms screamed and someone was dying. Code blue. You could no longer watch and wait and admire the problem. Your thoughts and actions were suddenly the difference between life and death. From the moment he walked into an ICU, Carter sensed it was where he was meant to be. The ICU rewarded his handiness. He could intubate anyone. "There are two skills you have to have in an ICU," he said. "You need to be able to put an IV into anybody, and you got to be able to stick a tracheal tube into anybody. You can't do that, and you are going to lose a patient." The ICU also grabbed his attention and kept it. "I loved it," he said. "The alarms would go off, and it was like someone gave me Ritalin. Everything else is cut out, and I can see the problem. I felt like I was my best when the shit hits the fan. I focus like a laser when everything is going to shit." There was this other thing he liked, too. The feelings the ICU left you with. If you didn't allow yourself to become numb, the place kept you alive to the complexity of life and its sanctity. When Carter first started teaching medical students in the early 1990s, he was working in a VA hospital. Most of the patients were blue-collar guys who had fought in the Second World War. All you saw as a doctor or medical student were these dying old men. But if you got them talking, you'd hear the most amazing stories. How they once flew their fighter plane under the Golden Gate Bridge. How they had taken Iwo Jima. "All of us are like a story," he'd tell students. "You're seeing the last two pages of the book. You know so little about him. He was once a little kid. He was your age once." And if you needed reminding of the benefits of life, you only had to watch people cling to it, even after they claimed they did not want to. Carter would never forget one crusty old World War II vet with incurable lung disease and a tube down his throat. He'd been able to communicate only by writing on a whiteboard. "I want to die," he'd written one day. The nurses brought Carter over. "I want you to take me off this goddamn machine and let me die," he wrote to Carter. Carter told him that if he really wanted to die, he could die. But maybe they should sleep on it, as death wasn't one of those procedures that was easy to reverse. The old vet wrote, "If you don't pull this tube out, I'm going to yank it out." "He was in a rage," said Carter. They brought in the chaplain and the family. Carter decided to change the subject. "What can we do to make you more comfortable?" he asked. The old vet studied him a beat and then wrote on the board, "Beer." "What kind of beer?" asked Carter. A few minutes later, Carter was at a gas station buying a six-pack. He gave it to the ICU nurse along with a formal prescription. "One can of beer a night." "I hand him the beer, and he has a smile on his face," said Carter, and he went to sleep. The old World War II vet decided he preferred to live, and he lasted a surprisingly long time. "People have this strong will," said Carter. "You feel it, you see it. It really was spiritual being in the ICU." Carter didn't spend a lot of time thinking about himself and about what made him different from other people. His mind naturally turned not inward, but outward. But he couldn't help but notice that very few medical students shared his enthusiasm for human beings on the brink of death. They felt the pressure. The pressure led to mistakes. Carter wound up hearing about a lot of these mistakes, but the first one he witnessed impressed him so deeply that he never forgot it. He was in Los Angeles, finishing his residency inside a county hospital ICU. They wheeled in an older woman suffering from both lupus and pneumonia and rapidly losing her ability to breathe. Carter intubated her and put her on a ventilator. At the end of his shift, he left thinking she had a fair chance of survival. "I came back the next day," he said, "and the bed's empty." He found the doctor who had followed him on duty. The guy was in shock. The woman had died after her lung had collapsed, he said. Right away, Carter knew what had happened. Every so often, the pressurized air pumped in by the ventilator escaped the lungs and entered the cavity that held the lungs. The air had nowhere to go, and the cavity expanded like a balloon, squeezing the lungs down. The pressure in the chest can grow so intense that it cuts off the flow of blood to the heart. He also knew what the doctor should have done: puncture the cavity in which the lung resided to release the air. You needed to feel for the top rib and then push in a needle hard just above it through the chest wall. "Didn't you stick a needle in her chest?" Carter asked, then regretted having asked it. The guy was a mess. He knew he'd choked. He'd asked for an x-ray so he could see what was happening inside the woman's chest. By the time he had the picture and the comfort of certainty, she was dead. "We used to tell ourselves, 'You're going to make a mistake,'" said Carter. "The sin is making the same mistake twice. The best is to learn from other people's mistakes." Carter didn't make mistakes in the ICU. At least none that mattered. Other people's mistakes, however, had a way of finding him. By 1991, he was running the ICU at the North Chicago Veterans Affairs Medical Center, a massive 1,000-bed hospital, when a cluster of patients in other units died from what appeared to be the mistakes of doctors. One old vet had turned up with back pain, for instance, and the VA doctor had prescribed Motrin and sent him home. 24 hours later, the vet was back at the hospital with a ruptured aorta. His back pain had been caused by an aneurysm missed by the VA doctor. The vet died in surgery. Several other bad outcomes in the hospital's surgery rooms triggered an investigation by the Department of Veterans Affairs, followed by a damning report. Mistakes in private sector medicine often never saw the light of day. The grievances they spawned could be resolved quietly by insurance companies. Mistakes inside a VA hospital had to be reported to Congress, where members of whichever party did not control the White House would set about blaming the president for mistreating veterans. "It became a pile-on," said Carter. "It became a game of finding everything that's wrong." None of what happened implicated him, but he couldn't escape it. The people who ran North Chicago were fired or reassigned. The VA banned the hospital from performing surgeries. Doctors and nurses left in droves so as not to be associated with the mess. The media was incessant. The Chicago Tribune ran a piece on the front page with the wife of a World War II veteran clutching a photo of her dead husband under the headline, "Widow says VA treated man like a lamb led to slaughter." Carter would emerge from the ICU to speak with the family of some new patient, only to find them watching a television report on the many ways North Chicago was killing everyone who walked through its doors. "I can't tell you how humiliating it was," he said. "You feel it, and you don't forget it." Carter didn't want to leave. He'd never been the leaving type. He liked the vets. That's why he hadn't pursued higher-paying jobs in the private sector. These old blue-collar guys reminded him of his dad and his uncle. "I felt I was one of the last ones left," said Carter. "Everyone was kind of deserting. The whole place is in turmoil." Plus, he knew that what had happened in the surgery was complicated. The VA's patients tended to be old and fragile. The New England Journal of Medicine had just published a study of medical mistakes. It showed that for every 1,000 people admitted to a hospital in the United States, 3 would die from error. The Veterans Health Administration treated 250,000 Americans a day. It was the second largest provider of medical care in the world, behind the UK's National Health Service. The entire scandal could have been a statistical artifact. In such a vast system, there were bound to be, as a matter of pure chance, clusters of error. He also knew that the VA surgeons were doing their best, and all of them could have made more money in private practice. "They don't come to work with the intention of harming anybody," Carter said. "People make mistakes." But whatever the reality, the perception overwhelmed it. The U.S. Congress held hearings to grill officials from the VA about its mistreatment of veterans in North Chicago. "People are walking around with their heads down," recalled Carter. "Surgeons, like these really confident guys, were totally destroyed." At the end of World War II, General Omar Bradley had taken charge of the Veterans Administration and forged strange and brilliant partnerships between its hospitals and local medical schools. The connections now ran so deep that, in North Chicago, it fell to the dean of the Chicago Medical School to sort out the mess. The dean found his way to Carter's ICU. "We have a crisis, and we need someone to fix it," the dean said to him. "I have zero interest," said Carter. He sensed he had been picked by process of elimination. He was 36 years old and had found his calling in critical care. He'd feel about a desk job, he suspected, the way he often felt about college lectures. There'd be nothing there to keep his mind from wandering all over the fucking place. The dean pressed Carter until he agreed, but only after his mind made a little leap. My strength is taking care of really sick patients, he said. We've got an entire medical center that has a really sick patient. It's a dying hospital. That's how I approached it. How do I stabilize it? He brought in a friend from his residency, Jim Tuchschmidt, to help him. Together they set about rebuilding the reputation of the hospital, a patient at a time. So here I am, said Carter. I'm really young, I'm really junior. I'm head of the hospital. It happened so fast, and I had no idea what to do. He replaced what had been an impersonal system with personal healthcare teams for each of the 30,000 or so veterans in North Chicago's care. He then measured everything that might be measured about the quality of the care given by each team. Acute bed days, emergency room visits, length of hospital stays, and so on. Once you had the data, you could see weaknesses more quickly and fix them. Prime Health, they called the new system.